David, you're on a Palestinian tour here in Australia. You were in Palestine. When and why?
2005, I went over there to do a tour in the West Bank and also Lebanon and Jordan. And I went because I wanted to go, but also because I had a friend who was living in Ramallah, Palestinian, Italian, American guy who wanted to organize the tour for me. So I went over there and I played 10 concerts around the West Bank and also did shows in Amman and Beirut and traveled around Lebanon with a friend who was a Lebanese-Palestinian woman who was living in Beirut at the time. So that was, I only been that one time. I did a tour of Israel actually in 99, but didn't make it to the occupied territories. So it's been my two visits to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine you were singing in English, and how was the tour received?
It was received wonderfully because, I mean, I think mainly people liked the idea of what I was doing. In terms of English, I mean, most people I ran into and most people who came to my shows didn't speak it fluently at all, or perhaps in many cases any English. But so I had lyric sheets, but if I were to do it again, I think the best way to do it is what I've been doing in my tours of Japan, which is to have an LCD projector and project the lyrics one verse at a time translated on a screen. That works brilliantly. You know, then you really like can almost completely overcome the language barrier. But just with lyric sheets, it's not so good because people just read through the lyrics before you sing the song, and then it doesn't have the kind of impact when it's like verse by verse on a screen.
You must have taken some of that experience back to the United States.
Well, sure, I did, but I think, I already was real familiar from lots of, you know, knowing lots of Palestinians and reading lots about life under the occupation. So there was really nothing new that I saw, and everything that happened while I was there was relatively tame compared to the stuff that happens quite regularly. But yeah, I was there I sang at a protest in the village of Belain, there was lots of tear gas and rubber bullets all over the place, but that was more near the end of the day after most of the internationals were gone. I heard about more of that than I actually saw. Went through, of course, loads of checkpoints. You can't help but do that. But, I mean, one of the things that really struck me was that, you know, it would be relatively easy to think that life isn't so bad under occupation if you only go there for a couple weeks, and if you don't understand that it's not just the sort of, you know, the frequent violence that, deployed by the Israeli troops at the checkpoints and elsewhere. It's the sort of invisible aspects of the occupation that's really the in a sense, the worst of it, the economic strangulation of all these towns. I mean, you know, the only cars that try to get out of the cities are the ones that have permits to get out of the cities, and there's very few of those. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't know unless you talk to people that, you know, everybody driving around their cars in a city like Nablus, they can drive their cars around Nablus and they can't get out of Nablus, you know. They're not allowed to. There's like two taxis in the entire city of Nablus that's allowed to leave Nablus.
Were you able to take the Palestinian experience to the people of the United States with song?
I had already at that time written 9 songs about the occupation and have not written any new ones specifically about the occupation since then, since I actually went there. Songwriting in some ways is a kind of hard to predict kind of thing. I mean, I do try to visit places, read books, do different things that might lead to songs, but you know, they may or may not lead to a good song, and I didn't feel like I had any new things to write about necessarily after I came back, so keep on doing the old ones that I wrote before then.
Are you going to do some tonight?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This particular gig is part of this sort of Palestine solidarity tour that Green Left Weekly and lots of local collaborators have put together. So, but of course, I always do songs about Palestine in my shows. I just do a little extra on these shows.
Yesterday, I was at a writers' festival down in Byron Bay, and there was a little panel of Australian songwriters. And they were asked, questions about how they wrote their songs and who influenced them. Could we maybe ask you the same question? You are quite prolific and your songs are quite powerful.
Well, I think a big part of the process is first sort of coming to realize that you are a human just like everybody else, and there's all these common human experiences that you can connect to and can write about in an authentic way, even if you're writing about people who are living lives and are in situations that are basically pretty unfamiliar to you. I'd say one of the biggest important things about becoming a good songwriter is completely steeping yourself in the tradition. I think that's true in any profession, you know. If you're really familiar with the good stuff that's been done before, and you know, really viscerally familiar, you know, you learn songs, you memorize songs, and listen to lots of other people's songs, and that, you know, gives you some, you know, basis to have some idea of how to write songs. And then doing good research, I think, is really key, and really sticking to the research and not making stuff up about situations that you're not totally familiar with, you know, but sticking to what you really know, and then writing or what you know, not necessarily from first-hand experience, but what you really know to be true, you know, based on either first-hand experience or research or some combination, and then sticking to that, and not kind of, you know, going off on some kind of improvised idea of what life might be like in like some village in Afghanistan. If you've never been to Afghanistan and you want to write a song about a village in Afghanistan, you better stick to exactly what the journalist who was there said. You know, if you find, you know, like good articles describing what was the scene like in this village, what was going on, and it's written by somebody who really was there, if you stick to those details and put it into a song, it can be quite convincing. And you know it's convincing when you sing it for Afghans and they're like, oh wow, you know, you've been there, and you're like, okay, good. You know, then, you know, if it moves the people you're writing about, then you know you're on to something.
So can I ask you what songwriters and musicians have influenced you and perhaps respected the values that you've just laid out before us?
I guess I've been influenced by all kinds of songwriters, but the ones who have had the most influence on me have been ones that that are so below the radar that they're certainly never played on commercial airwaves, and only if you were in the right place and time would you have heard of them. Like people like Jim Page from Seattle, Washington, has been a tremendous influence on me. People in Ireland know who he is, and people on the left on the West Coast in the U.S. would you know likely have heard his music, but pretty much nowhere else. But he's been a tremendous influence. And certainly Phil Oakes and Bob Dylan, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Buffy St. Marie, and lots of folks that, you know, a lot of people have heard of, and definitely been really influenced by the new song movement in Latin America. You know, folks like Silvio Rodriguez and Victor Jara. And, I don't speak Spanish, but I know a lot of people who are from Latin America, and they've turned me on to their music, and it had a tremendous impact. And also, I have to say, I've listened to a lot of Arabic music, and just from hanging out with Palestinians mainly, and that's been tremendously influential on me, especially in terms of the way that they. I mean, I don't know how much it comes across in my writing, because my writing tends to be more in your face than a lot of that stuff. But I find that from repressive regimes often comes the best music, because they have to couch everything in poetry, or else they'll get killed, you know. So, you know, I mean, I'm always shocked when I'm like sitting on a plane next to some, you know, wealthy, or relatively wealthy, you know, person from Mexico or someone, you know, somebody who can afford to fly. They're probably not from, you wouldn't think that they're from the usual demographic that would be big fans of like Silvio Rodriguez, but everybody loves Silvio Rodriguez. It doesn't matter whether they're right wing or left wing, and that's a fascinating phenomenon, given that he's a communist and he's on the, you know, he's in the Cuban parliament now. But you know, his music speaks to everyone, you know, even though I think, you know, that, you know, most people would, if they're analyzing his lyrics, they'd say, you know, clearly he's on the side of the oppressed, but you know, the businessmen like him too. It's interesting.
Oh, that's fascinating. And geez, you're familiar with some of the Middle Eastern musicians and singers and songwriters Is there something equivalent to the, well, the Latin American new song movement or, well, protest music anywhere, I guess?
Well, I'd say, I don't know how equivalent it is, because, I mean, like in the new song movement in Latin America, there's such an emphasis on people writing new songs that are about contemporary issues, and that definitely is a big part of Middle Eastern songwriting, although there's also a lot of taking old poems written hundreds of years ago and making them sort of contemporary by implication, by singing them about things that are happening now. You kind of like, you know what they're getting at, but because of the types of things that they're singing about that are often things that happened a long, long time ago, like Umm Kulthum, and the Egyptian singer. I don't think she ever wrote lyrics, but she used lyrics that were, I think, mostly really old. And then, of course, I'd say that the person who's most representative, I'd say, of the new song movement in the Arab world would be Marcel Khalife, and his, most of the songs that he wrote were actually, the lyrics were written by the poet Mahmoud Darwish, and that all is, very contemporary about, life on, now or 10, 20 years ago when they were writing most of their stuff. About life in Lebanon and Palestine.
I know we did speak earlier about the music industry and the place of music like yours in the music industry as it exists today, but I'm curious to know, I noticed we can download your songs from your website. You don't charge your copy left, as they say. You don't charge for the downloads. I'm sure if people want to buy your CDs, they're perfectly welcome to pay for it. But you are part of this. Do you see it as a new movement that the internet is or can affect the way popular music is being created and performed and presented today?
Yeah, definitely. I think the internet has had a tremendous impact, and the music industry is really, trying to cope. But mostly, they just hate it, and they're really doing everything they can, spending tremendous amounts of money to convince everybody that free downloading is somehow criminal, and they're suing them. They've sued like tens of thousands of Americans for thousands of dollars each, kind of thing, fining them for putting up a few songs on a peer-to-peer networking site and this sort of thing. They're really, it's a real sort of war of ideas that they're trying to wage in the minds of people in the U.S. and around the world to convince them that, this is really a sketchy thing they should avoid, and they really should be paying for everything. The thing is that, and they've also really duped a lot of musicians into believing their line. But the thing is that if you're a really well-known band like Metallica, for example, or Snoop Dogg, or some of these people who have really jumped on the industry bandwagon, full tilt, then of course they're losing record sales because they get so much conventional publicity anyway. But for the other literally 99% or probably more of musicians, it doesn't work that way. We don't get commercial airplay, we don't even get so-called public radio play, and we certainly don't get any conventional advertising. We get community radio airplay, and now we get found on the internet, and lots and lots of people are looking to the internet and finding all kinds of stuff that they wouldn't have found before, and it's free downloads and putting everything up for free download. Most musicians, I think, still aren't doing it. They're only putting up a few songs and putting them up as like streams and stuff. But if you put up all your stuff for free download, it creates a buzz, and you just develop so many more fans, and then that's what, then you get gigs. Like maybe every 1,000, 2,000 people who downloads the song will set up a gig, and then you make a living, because most musicians who aren't big bands, they make a living through performing, not primarily through CD sales. So you use the internet as a way of getting the music out there, and then you make a living by performing if people like it. That's like my theory on the sort of the business model of free downloads.
Yeah, so it's sort of maybe encouraging a trend back to live music.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if there was ever hope for many musicians to actually make a living through CD sales, which you know, might be more conceivable on a bigger scale if we didn't have Clear Channel controlling all the airwaves in a place like the U.S. and to a lesser extent, but still, you know, to a great extent in lots of other countries. It's the industry, you know, it's just a few corporations controlling so much of the airwaves. If that wasn't the case, then maybe you know, more of us could make a living by, you know, by as recording artists or as, you know, selling CDs. But that's really not realistic, especially in the age of the internet. But I think in a way, more so than any time since recording technology was developed in the first place, it's more and more possible to make a living as a performing artist. Although I think it's, you know, it's fair to say that we really, all musicians would be much better off if none of this technology existed, including the radio, you know. But then people really needed live music. But, you know, it's too late for that. And so I think, you know, in terms of technology, the most democratic technology, you know, the one that's most interactive is the one that we, that it's best for the regular folks out there, you know, and regular working musicians. And the internet is the most democratic technology in terms of, you know, any kind of recording technology or, you know, anything like that. I mean, it's so much better than, you know, records or the radio, or, I mean, it's maybe the FM airwaves in the 1960s was different. I mean, that was more of a participatory thing, but we haven't had anything like that, certainly in the U.S. for 40 years. But the internet is really, yeah, it's great.
Well, we're certainly going to be looking forward to your live performance tonight, and enjoy the rest of your tour of Australia. And do you have any more comments you'd like to make?
Oh no! Just keep doing what you're doing. It's yeah, we gotta seize the airwaves in all ways possible, and citizen journalism and all kinds of grassroots journalism is what we need a lot more of.
Okay. Thanks very much, David.
Okay. Thank you.